Good morning. I'd like to mention a quick program note before we begin. Mr. Shifter, our speaker today, has prepared a background paper to his remarks here today, and we've made that available on the Miller Center website under the forum program. It's an excellent analysis and synopsis of recent trends in the region, and so I invite you to take a look and to download the paper. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our guest today is Michael Shifter, Vice President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue in Washington. Since 1993, Mr. Shifter has also been an adjunct professor of politics at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. He writes widely on U.S.-Latin American relations and has regularly testified before Congress regarding U.S. policy towards the region. He is co-editor of Constructing Democratic Governance in Latin America, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, and is a contributing editor to Current History and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Prior to his current appointment, Shifter directed the Latin American and Caribbean program at the National Endowment for Democracy, and prior to that, the Ford Foundation's Governance and Human Rights program in the Andean region and the Southern Cone. Please join me in welcoming Michael Shifter.
Thank you very much, Christina, for that very nice introduction. I'm honored to be at the Miller Center, I appreciate all of you coming this morning. I appreciate the focus as well on Latin America, a region that has not so much been neglected, I think, as treated as almost a discrete compartment, almost a separate part of the brain, deals with Latin America than deals with the rest of the world. In other regions of the world, we tend to look at what U.S. interests are and then come up with some strategic choices and policy decisions. In Latin America, all of the issues, trade, immigration, drugs, Cuba, whatever the issue, the policy options tend to be the product of U.S. domestic politics almost entirely. To give you an example, the decision to build a wall on the border between the United States and Mexico, which was supported by both Senator McCain and Senator Obama, was made without any consideration or any thought given to how this gesture would be viewed south of the border, not only in Mexico, but throughout Latin America. It was purely a product of domestic politics. Because of the regions of geography, the proximity to Latin America, the history, and the power disparity, the power differential that's existed for many years, the U.S. has had a paternalistic tutorial attitude towards the region, more so than it has towards other regions of the world. And my main point today, this morning, is to make the case that a new mindset is called for to respond constructively to a new reality in Latin America, and that whoever the next president is will need to understand the changes that have taken place in recent years and that are taking place today, and to overcome the traditional reflex and impulse that has often marked U.S. policy making towards Latin America. There's always a temptation, and we read about in the press, to say the region is moving in this direction or is moving in that direction. And a couple of years ago, the press was fond of saying there's been a shift to the left in Latin America. I think one has to be careful about these labels and about these catch-all terms, because they don't really capture the complexity and the different directions that Latin America is moving at the same time. Latin America has always been diverse, but is perhaps more differentiated today than ever before, and it's going to become more differentiated in the future. So what I want to talk to you about this morning is at least three broad categories to try to break down this very complex, challenging region. The first is the Mexico, the group of countries that are closest to the United States, that are more integrated, connected to the United States, Mexico, Central America, the Caribbean. Here I would include Colombia as well. Second is a group of countries principally led by Hugo Chavez of Venezuela and what his revolution is all about, which is also a very important trend and current in the region. And the third are rising, ascendant, globalizing countries like Brazil and Chile, which are also positioning themselves very different vis-a-vis the United States and with relation to the whole global economy. Let me just briefly sort of outline how each of them, what's driving them, and what distinguishes one from the other. It's hard to overstate how interconnected Mexico is with the United States today and what the extent of the bilateral relationship is. Covers all issues, whether it's trade. Over 80% of the trade from Mexico is with the United States. Migration, we all know about the extraordinary high levels of migration. The drug issue, energy. Mexico is a major oil producer. And of course, the remarkable cultural intermingling between the United States and Mexico, which is very clear in many parts of the United States. Remittances that are sent by Mexicans to their families living here to their families in Mexico are extraordinarily high, as well as to Central America and the Caribbean. They form an important part, a big share of the economies of those countries. With the recent financial crisis in the United States, the downturn in the economy, the estimates are that remittances have dropped some 12% recently from the United States to Mexico. This, of course, has huge implications for the situation in Mexico, as well as questions of tourism, investment, and the like. So, with this set of countries, we have increasingly strong relationship. President Bush, I think, had it right when he said on September 5th, 2001, at the White House dinner for Vicente Fox, the Mexican president, when he said, quote, that Mexico was our most important relationship. What's happening today in Mexico may in fact force the next administration, force the next president to focus more than we think of today, or that we expect today when we're talking about Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the like. Mexico had a single party system. That changed in the year 2000, but today it is being racked by drug-fueled violence. Cartels, mafias are taking over many towns. There are almost 3,000 deaths due to the violence in Mexico a year. After Iraq, Mexico is the second most dangerous place for journalists to practice their trade in the world today. And you do have a real threat to the rule of law in a country which is significant, which is right on our border, and where a lot of this violence is spilling over. You just have to pick up the newspaper, any newspaper these days, to see the extent of the chaos, instability, fear, and the like. Central America and the Caribbean are also facing similar threats. They are smaller countries, more vulnerable. Their governments are weaker than Mexico's government, so they're even having a harder time contending with these forces. Now, a lot of what's happening in Mexico has to do with, obviously, the demand, consumption of drugs. The United States is not unrelated to that. Most of the demand, consumption of drugs is in the United States, although Europe is also a major source of consumption, as is Mexico itself. Mexico consumption of drugs is going up significantly. Almost all of the arms that are used in the violence in Mexico and the killings that we read about are from the United States. And there's very little serious effort so far to control or regulate those arms that are coming from the United States. So again, there are deep connections between what's happening in Mexico and of course, the United States. The US Congress just approved of something called the Merida Initiative, which is a program, $1.4 billion over 3 years, to help Mexico and Central America deal with this issue. But I doubt it will be enough, and I think the next president will have little choice but to focus on what's happening just south of our border. Colombia is another country which is also very closely tied to the United States. Colombia has been the largest recipient of US security aid in the world outside of the Middle East since 2000. Over $5 billion has been given to Colombia to deal with the drug question and to try to improve the situation of the drugs in inner cities in the United States. That was the original motivation for US aid to Colombia. The drug problem continues more serious than ever. There's very little evidence that it's improved. But this aid, I think, has led to an improvement in the security situation in Colombia. And levels of violence have gone down somewhat, and the state has been able to assert its authority. So there has been some results, I think, on security, but the drug issue continues to be very serious. The United States has trade deals with all of these countries, NAFTA, of course, with Mexico, CAFTA with Central America, the Dominican Republic. There's also a trade agreement with Colombia that has been negotiated but not yet approved by the US Congress. And of course, this was a subject in the last presidential debate between the two candidates, the concern of Senator Obama being the violence against union officials still in Colombia. But whoever is the president on January 20th will have to deal with a trade agreement that's been negotiated by both governments, approved by the Colombian Congress, and it awaits a decision here, awaits a decision here in the US government in Washington. Despite these profound connections on economics, on migration, remittances, all of these issues, the cultural intermingling, it's important to note that even these countries that are tied in basic ways to the United States, increasingly so, in political terms, want some elbow room, greater distance, greater independence from the United States. When Mexico was a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council and voted against US decision to go into Iraq, this was taken very, very hard by people in Washington. How could a close ally like Mexico take a decision against a good friend like the United States? But it was a signal that Mexico, like the rest of Latin America, will go with the United States on some, go along with the United States on some issues, but go against it on others. This is something new and something unexpected. And it's a new part of the new reality that even countries that are so profoundly connected with the United States will take some distance on a range of important political issues. Second group of countries is we hear about a lot is led by Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, who in February will complete a decade in office. Chavez presides over a system whose political parties, political establishment virtually collapsed. There have been growing demands and expectations of new groups that have become involved in Venezuela's politics that have been excluded from politics before. There's a very strong reliance on oil, natural resources, in this case oil, and some of the other countries, natural gas. This is an attempt to try to carry out what Chavez calls a Bolivarian revolution, building solidarity, integration in Latin America to challenge the United States. Chavez, I believe, is committed to not only building a multipolar world, but also his grandiose initiatives are aimed at curtailing and challenging U.S. power in this hemisphere and throughout the world. He's been able to sustain himself in power for 10 years because of the ineptitude of the opposition in Venezuela, because of contradictory policies and incoherent policies of the United States, and because he put his finger on a legitimate grievance that many Venezuelans and many Latin Americans feel, which is unjust social injustice and the vast disparity between the rich and the poor and the corruption of the old elites. This has had enormous appeal in Venezuela and throughout the region. And Chavez has carried out social programs called missions that are also aimed at helping on giving access to medical care, literacy training, and the like to some poor constituents in Venezuela, which, of course, have helped him gain the popularity he has. He has about 55% support in the polls today after 10 years in power. Of course, when he arrived in power, the oil was $10 a barrel, less than $10 a barrel, even though it's gone down considerably to its level of $145 a barrel. It's still considerably more than it was when he came into office. And so he still has a lot of options and a lot of room to work with, even though he is clearly affected by this drop, this precipitous drop in oil prices that we're seeing. And it's anybody's guess how that's going to sort itself out. But he clearly, his ability to sustain his political project in Venezuela, in Latin America, is closely tied to the price of oil. Ironically, Chavez sells more oil, exports more oil to the United States than any government even before Chavez. So the economic ties are very, very strong between Venezuela and the United States, despite the fact that there's been tremendous political hostility and political tension. So the State Department doesn't have good relations with Chavez, but the Commerce Department works very well with Chavez because well over 50% of his oil exports come to the United States. The United States gets around 8 or 9% of oil imports today from Venezuela. Despite his popularity, there are some clear soft spots, I would say, or seeds of decay in Chavez's rule. Inflation is the highest in Latin America today, about 35%, three times the regional average. Crime is off the charts. The drug issue, Venezuela as a transit point and its connection to the crime question, is a very, very important concern according to all the polls in Venezuela. Most people are very worried about this security problem. There are reports of corruption. This is a system where there are very few checks or constraints on executive rule, and we know what happens when there's a lot of money and there are few constraints or checks on executive rule. This corruption is not far behind. So there are some serious problems, and the oil question is price is going to be an important factor in seeing how long this experiment, this revolution, will last. There are similarities with other countries in Latin America, Bolivia being the most important, where Evo Morales, an indigenous leader, is also leading a revolution. He has significant reserves of natural gas. Rafael Correa, president of Ecuador, which is also an oil producer, has similarly challenged the old political establishment, is getting a lot of support from people who were not part of the political process before. Chavez is the key player in this dynamic, but all of these other countries would have seen probably similar political results, the rise of Morales, the rise of Correa, these other leaders who are very asserting their national interest, trying to defy the power of multinational corporations getting better terms for their oil or natural gas with or without Chavez. These are a product of the particular circumstances of these societies and also very, very important process that's going on in Latin America. Chavez himself, I don't think, should be seen as a threat to the United States. I think to compare him to other countries with nuclear capacity that can really do harm to the United States, I think, is overdone. But on the other hand, he is a challenge. He has a lot of money, he has a lot of influence, and he does have a very clear agenda that does try to defy US interests. He also is a global player and increasingly has ties with countries like China, Russia, Iran. Chavez is attempting to divert the exports that currently go to the United States to China. That's the obvious place. They've increased from around 12,000 barrels a day to now about 350,000 barrels a day go to China. But clearly, there are a lot of obstacles to doing that. It makes more economic sense for a variety of reasons to export to the United States. But for political reasons, he seems determined to try to shift that market. Russia and Iran are more of concern, especially to the extent that Russian-US relations or Iranian-US relations are problematic, are more tense, are more strained. Chavez is buying lots of arms from Russia and has a close alliance and friendship with the Iranian government. This is sort of also part of the dynamic that the United States, I think, needs to be concerned about and watch, but again, not overreact or try to exaggerate the challenge that's posed. The final set of countries are those that I call the ascendant globalizers. And this is led by Brazil, a country whose rise has been, transformation has really been quite remarkable, both in political and economic terms. It will have had two world-class leaders in Fernando Henrique Cardoso and Lula, the current president, who will have been in office for 16 years, both two-term presidents, popular presidents. It has a $1.6 trillion economy within the 10 top largest economies in the world. And it's called one of the so-called BRIC countries, the countries that will achieve preeminence in coming years along with Russia, India, and China. Even its Achilles heel, inequality between the difference and the gap between the rich and the poor, has declined under the Lula government, thanks to a very vigorous social program which gives income transfers to poor Brazilians. Brazil is forging deeper relationships with countries like Brazil and China. Now its trade with China is over $23 billion a year. Foreign direct investment has been booming in China. Its oil company, Petrobras, is a sharp contrast to the Venezuelan oil company, PDVSA. It's much better run, much more entrepreneurial, much better governance than the Venezuelan case. These are very sharp differences between the two countries. It's become a world leader in biofuels and in ethanol and biodiesels. And there also is a major oil discovery in Venezuela, in Brazil, which could make it a significant, very significant energy producer and only add to the optimism and its move really to become a very significant global power. It's also playing an important role in Latin America. It created something called the Union of South American Nations, which is now increasingly involved in working out problems, crises that emerge in Colombia, Ecuador, Venezuela, the internal problems of Brazil and Bolivia. Brazil has become an important, more assertive regional player Latin America. Its attitude towards the United States is to agree on some issues, disagree on other issues, doesn't have the confrontational style that you see in Hugo Chavez, but has also asserts its own independence and considers itself a very serious power, wants a seat very badly on the UN, a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. Clearly, there are problems in Brazil. There's been corruption problems, other policy challenges, and it's not affected by the US financial crisis. It's certainly not immune, and we see some real difficulties because of what's happened in the US and globally recently. But it seems to have established strong political and economic foundations to weather some of these challenges. Chile is in the same category as Brazil and has been seen as perhaps the best performer in Latin America politically, economically, and socially since the end of the Pinochet period in 1990, 1991. It's the only Latin American country today with a free trade agreement with China. It has some 28 agreements, trade agreements throughout the world. So it's a country that is really the consummate quintessential globalizer and is exercising its options as a small country, but a country with a very vigorous strategy on the global economy. It has a socialist government, has succeeded in reducing poverty in recent years. It too, along with Mexico, voted against the United States position on Iraq. When it was a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council. It was a decision that did not go over very well in Washington. But again, Chile is going to assert its own position, and the United States may have been disappointed, but it had to put aside that disappointment and go forward and deal with Chile, even despite this disagreement. This has been a kind of a selective overview. But there's one country that's dominated Washington's attention for nearly 50 years. As a matter of fact, in January, it'll be 50 years exactly since Fidel Castro took power in Cuba. It's that four-letter word, Cuba. There's been no issue that's been more responsible for straining U.S.-Latin American relations because of the U.S. embargo on Cuba. In February, it will be 1 year since Fidel Castro stepped aside and his brother Raul Castro took over. There have been, I think, some modest changes on the margins and greater access to hotels and cell phones and appliances and the like. And what we see is probably the biggest change is that there's very little change. There's a lot of stability, not much has changed. It's clear that the Cuban regime is well prepared for any succession. Many people who have expected some dramatic, abrupt change, I think have seen that that's not unlikely to happen. Cuba, like the rest of Latin America, is also increasingly asserting its national interest, looking for alliances not only with Venezuela, where it receives a major subsidy because of oil, discounted oil, but also with Russia, China, Brazil, other countries. Clearly, they are trying to pursue a foreign policy and take advantage of as many options and opportunities in the world stage as they possibly can. Guantanamo has been a very sore issue for a long time in U.S. Latin American relations. You can imagine what the impact in Latin America of reported abuses and have been on the region. The good news is that both Senator McCain and Senator Obama favor closing down the facility, which I think in itself will help U.S. Standing in Latin America. Senator Obama's emphasis on diplomacy, on direct talks with the Cuban leadership is also seen as encouraging. Even though he is not supporting lifting the embargo, he does want to remove the restrictions on remittances and travel of Cuban Americans. That is at least seen as a modest but important step in the right direction. Cuba's symbolic significance should not be, could not be overstated in terms of how Latin Americans will see the United States. So how the Cuba issue is handled is going to be a very important test for the next administration that will be watched very carefully throughout the region. There are formidable constraints on making progress on the rest of the agenda in US Latin American relations. The trade question is going to become difficult because of the crisis in this country, the concerns about the domestic economy, Americans turning inward in many ways. But again, Latin Americans are very much more committed to free trade and globalization, less anxious about globalization if we believe the reports of the Pew survey than the rest of Latin America. And the United States, of course, doesn't have an option really of retreating and just looking inside. So this is going to be a major challenge as we move forward. Immigration has been an issue of great importance to Latin Americans, not just in Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean, but even if you go to South America, a country like Uruguay, President Bush's last trip to South America, this was one of the top issues for discussion of the president of Uruguay is immigration. Clearly, Latin Americans would welcome a more liberal, comprehensive immigration reform in the United States, but we all understand that that's also extremely difficult because of domestic political reasons. The drug issue is one that's been on automatic pilot in the United States for years, but it continues to have very bad consequences in Latin America in terms of violence, corruption, deterioration of institutions. Economic costs have been enormous, and any president who says he is willing to rethink drug strategy and work and consult with Latin American neighbors, I think, would be enthusiastically cheered in Latin America. Is seen as a policy that has failed and that needs serious rethinking. I don't see a lot of new, fresh thinking yet on Latin America. Hopefully, after a week from tomorrow, after the election, when we know who won and who lost, there'll be a greater emphasis on looking at some of these policy challenges. I think Senator McCain has had more of a Cold War mindset, going back to what Ronald Reagan did in the 1980s in Central America. Senator Obama has, I think, more of a mindset, and some of his speeches on Latin America have had echoes of John Kennedy and some of Bill Clinton in the 1990s. But Latin America is at a different point than it was in the 1960s and the 1990s, and the United States is at a different point. Its capacity to shape developments, to influence what's happening, has changed dramatically. And that's what has to be taken into account and has to adjust the mindset in the United States. It's a different region. Brazil's at a different place. Chavez is a phenomenon that wasn't there before. Mexico, the profound connections. And that means we have to be very strategic, very selective on how we deal with this region moving forward. I think there needs to be a much greater thrust and concern with multilateralism. We have in this region the Organization of American States, which is the oldest political regional organization in the world. For many years, it lacked credibility because it was dominated by the United States. It was used as an instrument of US power. Then the US became uninterested and the Latin Americans used it, but the United States disengaged and withdrew. And the test, I think, moving forward in this region, as well as throughout the world, is if the United States has the capacity to take these multilateral organizations, these regional organizations, seriously, to give them some commitment, some resources, but also understand that there will be some issues where it's not going to have its way, and that Latin Americans will have their way. On other issues, the U.S. will get its way. And that is the essence, I think, of what multilateralism is about. And I think I would look for that, hopefully, for the next administration. And the good news is that if the United States behaves in that way and changes its approach and attitude towards that multilateralism, it will be widely cheered throughout Latin America. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael. In a few moments, I'll head to the back of the room to begin taking questions. So I invite the audience to please line up in the back to ask your question. But let me begin the conversation by asking if you could share your views on what explains the left of center election success in Latin America that began perhaps with Chavez in Venezuela a decade ago, and then continue with Lula in Brazil, Kirchner in Argentina, and then more recently in Nicaragua, Bolivia, and Ecuador, and others. Is this simply due to declining U.S. influence and to the persistence of poverty and poor economic performance, or is there more to this story that we're not realizing?
Thank you. Well, I think there are two major trends that I think are characteristic of the whole region. One is greater distance, independence from the United States. And the second is that the social agenda is much more important than it was. It's clear that a lot of the recipes for economic policy, whether you want to call them the Washington Consensus, neoliberalism, whatever name you want to use for these prescriptions, that a lot of people thought in the early 1990s, mid-1990s, were going to result in dramatic improvements, clearly didn't. And so you had a lot of people who were angry, frustrated, and with globalization, you had people with access to greater information, so that inequality becomes an important political issue. And therefore, there are greater demands and there's greater insistence on selecting leaders who are committed to reducing inequality. And those leaders tend to come from the left or the left to center more than the right, although I think it's important to note, even if you look at some governments that are considered right of center, the Mexican government, for example, of Calderon, his main priority is fighting poverty. So any political leader who wants to get elected these days needs to take seriously the social agenda. Almost every country has social programs in place, income transfer programs targeted to the poor. And I think that is what explains the shift. There is this tremendous demand and grievance to try to reduce the gap. There's a sense that policy prescriptions haven't worked. And I think that the political leadership is responding accordingly.
What words would you have for the president-elect regarding future drug policy?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that the president-elect should do something that hasn't been done since the Bush father administration in the late 80s, early 1990s, which is to sort of have a special meeting with his counterparts in the region to listen to what they have to say about how the drug policy is working or not working and how they'd like to move to in a more productive way. That exercise hasn't taken place. Didn't take place under the Clinton administration. It didn't take place under the eight years of this Bush administration. And the problem has gotten worse, not better, since those multilateral summits back then. I think, first of all, I would tell the president-elect not to have these kind of certification exercises, which is sort of evaluating Latin America on their performance and cooperating on drugs. Bolivia was just decertified. This creates unnecessary irritation in U.S.-Latin American relations. The United States is not in any position to evaluate or give grades to Latin Americans on their performance on drugs, given the problems in this country. So I would eliminate all of those instruments of drug policy, which cause more problems than anything else. And I would look at ways to really rethink the policy. Perhaps to legalization is probably politically very difficult, but perhaps decriminalization of some areas, which is happening at the state level and is being proposed in Latin America, might get a push politically by a president-elect. It would make a big difference. It would send an important signal that may be a direction to go. There may be greater, it's a place where multilateralism, I think, could work. today we have this relationship of the United States has a drug relationship, on a relationship of drug policy with Mexico, another one on Bolivia, another one on Colombia, another one on Peru, and yet these countries don't really work with each other seriously at a high political level as they should. And so that whole approach and that logic needs to sort of break down, and I would urge the next president to play a strong leadership role on that issue.
I know that Argentina is a very special case, but how do you situate it in your categories, or does it need a category for itself?
Well, thank you. Argentina is, in the paper I did, I have a section on Argentina. I didn't mention it because it's just a lot to cover. I do think it has it's one of these cases where I think it has contradictory characteristics. There are parts of it, of Argentina, that was similar to its neighbors, Chile and Brazil, and being sort of globalizers. There's other parts of Argentina which perhaps are more similar to the category of Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador. There's a lot of nationalism. There's been a lot of tension with the United States, and so I think it's Argentina is one of these countries that sort of straddles both of the variety of categories. I also didn't mention Peru, which is another one that I think doesn't quite fit as easily in these categories. So I think these are very fluid situations, and it just didn't strike me that it really was a right match, but I think Argentina does have these very peculiar characteristics that don't make it fit in any one category.
I'd be interested in your views on evolutionary contrast between North America, United States, and South America, say post-Columbus. South America with rich resources and agriculture, probably richer than the United States, and yet chaos down there has been kind of the pattern in all these countries. We started as states, now united. But one wonders what the factors are. Has it got to do with English rule of law that has led to a certain amount of stability? We did have a civil war. The founding brothers, as opposed to maybe some of the conquistadors. Why have we turned out so differently over these hundreds of years?
Well, that's a... that's a... That's a profound question, and a big question, but a very, very good question. It's very much on the mark, and I think the answer would probably be that I'm most comfortable with is probably a combination of a lot of different factors. I think there are the leadership that you alluded to is a problem. I also think one has to distinguish in South America, again, not to lump all of the countries together. There are sharp differences, and there are countries like a Chile, which is in South America, which has made a lot of progress, has a history of democratic institutions, and so forth. And so I think there are differences, but I do think the quality of political leadership is a major factor. I also think global conditions and structural conditions and sort of market opportunities is another factor. But I think one shouldn't underestimate that there's been a lot of progress. There's a book out you may have seen that was written by Mike Reed, who was the editor of The Economist, the America section of The Economist. On Latin America, and he, it's quite a, if you read the book, it's quite a optimistic survey, and saying that on a lot of dimensions, Latin America, South America has improved a lot. If you look at literacy and mortality and a lot of other areas, there has been progress, and I think the image he was trying to challenge was one of the sort of stuck, stalled, going backwards, It's called The Forgotten Continent by Yale University Press. So I think sometimes the image is one way, I mean, I think what you say is true, and I think there's some factors to explain that. I'm partial to the leadership issue, because I think there's a lot there. But I also think, if you read this book, that there's been probably more progress on some of these critical areas than is generally recognized.
I'm going to introduce myself by way of saying that I spent over a decade in South America. Not that I'm an expert on the subject, but one of the things that seems to bother me about Venezuela is that Chavez has obviously got it in mind that he wants to establish, as you remarked before, a Bolivarian region of at least the Andean countries. And the fact that he has already signed agreements with Russia for $4 billion in military aid and is now working on another $1 billion from Russia indicates to me that the objective is very much a clear and present danger to Colombia. And I'd like to get your comments on that.
Well, Colombia is mainly concerned about the rifles and the factory that Russia is investing in Colombia, because these are rifles that are used by the FARC guerrillas that obviously Colombia is fighting against, and they're concerned about that. Some of the sort of the other equipment that Russia would be providing to Venezuela is not, the Colombians aren't as worried about. They don't really worry as much that Venezuela is going to attack Colombia. Colombia has a significant military advantage over Venezuela. And of course, it has U.S. Support. So that was not what makes Colombia nervous. They were nervous about some of the small arms that could be easily smuggled over the border, and or the FARC itself goes back and forth between the border, between Venezuela and Colombia, and it could get in their hands. And of course, that's what they're worried about. So that's, at least the officials that I've talked to in the Colombian government, that's what they focus on, and they're worried about it. I think that, I think clearly in light of the crisis in Georgia and the situation there, the arms purchases by Venezuela of Russian arms becomes more, from the United States perspective, becomes more of a concern. But I do think for the Colombians, they're principally worried about that. They're not, I think, worried about that they're going to be attacked by the Venezuelans. They have superior military position than the Venezuelans.
Thank you for your presence here and discussing a very important area of the world. I have, when you talk about the independence of the South American countries from the United States in some ways, and making, they're not going along with everything, in other words. My question is, how has this come about? Because it looks like, it would seem to me that if the tax bases of these countries improve, they're less dependent upon the lending policies of the United States. And, excuse me, this is a little close. And have the tax bases improved to the extent that they can be a little more independent and negotiate a little more comfortably on their own terms? Or what accounts for this?
Well, I think the main reason, one of the conventional views is that the United States, which I don't accept, is that the United States has sort of lost interest and therefore these countries have had to find other sources of support. I think that's part of it, but I think it's more just, I think it has to do mainly with this is changes in the world. And you know, the rise of China and the rise of India and new markets and interest of Europe and Latin America, Japan some years ago, Spain, There's just lots more opportunities and connections there. And a lot of countries like Brazil and Venezuela, Mexico, others, Chile, just had been much more provincial. And in addition, especially over the last 6 years or so, since 5 years, since 2003, before the current economic crisis and financial crisis, you know, these Latin American countries were experiencing the biggest boom that they had in many years because of the commodities, and whether it's soy or whether it's gold or whatever it is, and mining. And so a lot of that demand was not coming from the United States. That increased demand. And so that has sort of given them I think it really has to do with globalization itself in that sense. It probably was inevitable. The fact that the United States became kind of turned inward a little bit and just sort of gave up on Latin America or didn't take advantage of opportunities in Latin America economically, I think, as it should have, probably accelerated that process. But I think it was there, you know, it was there anyway. And of course, the capital access to capital markets, you know, globally, I think sort of moved Latin America in a different position. So now it's in a much stronger position. And I think also just also the political aspects as well. Despite problems in democracy in Latin America, moved towards authoritarianism in some countries. You know, Latin America is having elections, a lot of elections, and regular elections. And that gives it a little bit more stability and sort of like a shock absorber for some of these other problems that they didn't have years ago when there was, you know, coups and militaries coming in, militaries coming out, a lot of instability. And so the United States was the stable country. There's more stability despite some of the concerns about democracy there. So I think it's a combination of those reasons.
I guess some of the questions that were asked this morning that sort of interrelated and your answers are, you know, hopefully my question is not a duplicate to an extent. But having spent a good portion of my working life in South America, it was always obvious to me that the U.S. was always more interested in other parts of the world than Latin America. I mean, most of our presidents waited till the very end of their tenure before they took the family for a jaunt, for a trip to visit South America before they left the office. My question is really two parts. Why don't we have any genuine interest in South America or Latin America? And are we waiting for the others, such as Russia, Iran, or China, to get involved before we start getting interested?
Well, thank you. I mean, I think my view is that it's short-sighted not to have the interest in Latin America. I think there are some sort of prejudices or biases that shape the mindset of a lot of policymakers, which kind of take Latin America for granted in some ways. It's there, it's close. You know, we don't have to worry about Latin America, or if there's a problem, well, that's the Latin Americans, and it's somehow seen as I think as what I was trying to say before, separate. Sort of different part of the brain. I mean, it's just so you miss the opportunities, the fact of the energy produced, the fact of the economy, just a lot of opportunities that the United States simply doesn't see. So other countries become, you know, much higher on the policy agenda. You know, the argument that other would force other countries would have to get involved deeply to sort of force the United States to focus. One would have thought that, but you know, if you look at the role of China and India, I mean, it has increased dramatically, and over the last years. The United States still hasn't been really able, at least during the last several years, to really give the kind of serious attention to the region that it deserves. So it's just been very preoccupied, very distracted by other what's happening in the world, and we don't feel that anybody in Latin America is going to attack us, which is true. Other parts of the world, they may be thinking of attacking us, and so that's where we have to focus our attention. Other countries have nuclear weapons, and Latin America doesn't. So it's that kind of thinking. I think it's short-sighted. I think it also is very much a product of the last few years, where I think there's been a kind of a sort of a distraction, high level of distraction, and that hopefully will change with the new administration. It's been very hard to reverse that. That you know, the people will look south and see the sort of the importance, and they may not have any choice again from with what's happening in Mexico, and that begins to really spill over in a significant way on the U.S. side. That becomes a major security question that the U.S. cannot avoid. So I think it's this just traditional mindset, and I think it has to do with just the proximity of Latin America, the history of this power, that they're weak, we're strong, on all these dimensions, that has led to this kind of take-it-for-granted attitude, but I think has to change.
You spoke about both the importance of immigration and U.S.-Cuban relations as issues, and I was wondering what the Latin American perceptions of the particular U.S.-Cuban immigration policy might be.
Well, I think the Latin Americans are, you know, just would be in favor of much more opening on immigration policy. They've both in terms of the Cuba issue and generally. They are, you know, that's a big source point in U.S. Latin American relations, and it's hard to overstate it. It's just what one hears about immigration and politics that get a little bit nasty has repercussions in Latin America, and I certainly think that in terms of the Cuba relationship that. They would be mostly in favor of just a greater opening and relaxation of travel and any kind of immigration, that it would be open on all sides. I mean, that's what they would like to see. Eventually, they understand that there are political problems in getting there, and it can't happen quickly. But that's the end point that I think they would support.
Michael, you've certainly been persuasive about why this area of the world is very important to us. And yet, I think you characterized the thinking or the policy prescriptions that are being given in both of the political or presidential candidates is a lack of fresh ideas. Why is that? And we certainly ought to be pretty concerned about it.
Well, thank you, Anne. I think I'm concerned about it. I think... Senator Obama has had a little bit of a broader view, but if you read his speech, you know, his ideas of sending more Peace Corps volunteers to Latin America or opening up more consulates in Latin America is probably not going to be greeted with great enthusiasm throughout the region. This is not a region that's at a point where makes a lot of sense. These are old ideas. And John Kennedy, you know, it may have made sense in the 1960s. It doesn't make sense in 2008. I think the short answer to your question, the honest answer is that, you know, it hasn't been important for winning the election. Focus on these questions. Hopefully, after the person is elected a week from tomorrow, it will be important to be successful in this set of policies. And it hasn't been important to come up with fresh ideas to get support from the American electorate to get to the White House. But hopefully that calculus will change, and I think there'll be a window and an opportunity to try to rethink some of these things. And then I think we can kind of, you know, work on it, because I think it really, it's a new world, and the ideas are generally pretty stale, at least the ones that I've seen. But I just think the campaign hasn't been worried about it because it doesn't make any difference in terms of their chances of getting to the White House.
I'd like to find out from you what role or roles do you see that U.S. universities, the University of Virginia, might play in fostering better dialogue and discussion policy changes towards Latin America?
Well, I think this is a tremendous area of opportunity, again, for deepening the relationship across a variety of dimensions. There's been some of that with Latin America, of course, today, but I think there's just tremendous room for expanding the sort of innovation, technology, transfer of information, knowledge. Certainly Latin American universities are a point where they're very, you know, excited about that. and would be very open, enthusiastic about that prospect. So I think it's a region, and certain countries clearly, you know, more so than others, again, the Chile, the Brazil, those countries, Mexico, which have universities that I think would be in a better position to deepen those kind of relationships. But I think this is an opportunity to move a lot. And if you go to conferences in Latin America, they talk about this a lot, about really greater collaboration, higher level of collaboration with U.S. universities and Latin American universities. And I think that it would overall be a tremendous contribution to improving the relationship.
Michael, thank you very much for your talk here today, and especially for bringing the region back to the attention of policymakers. Thank you. Thank you.